From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Ali. So the French got caught with their trousers down, selling arms to warlords, eh? If you ever get a chance, watch a Nicolas Cage film called Lord of War. It's very revealing. And Betfred and Ladbrokes are taking bets on how long the next shaking episode of Angela Merkel will last. All right, that might be a bit below the belt, that might not be funny.
Richie Allen.
Yeah. Welcome to the program. How you doing? It's Wednesday's show.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
It isn't funny. It's not funny at all. Welcome to the program. I've got some brilliant guests lined up for you today. We're back up and running. The brilliant Professor Julian Petley joins me live from London to talk about, well, this conference going on in the UK about how to spread media freedom around the world. This is very interesting and it's very important. The brilliant Julian Petley live on the program in about 20 minutes' time. And in the second hour of the programme, I'm going to be talking about a brand new documentary film which will be released in September called Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. I'll be talking to the director of the film, Richard Willett, and also one of the contributors, Neil Sanders, of course. You know Neil. Neil has been on this programme many times before. I mentioned him yesterday. Fascinating film. Really interesting. And very pertinent. Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. We'll get into that in the second hour. On Wednesday's Richie Allen Show, it is July 10th, 2019. And the sun has got his hat on in Salford, in this dirty old town. In Salford, it's sunny, it's warm. It's a sweatbox. It's a sweatbox in studio. It's a sweatbox in studio. I have no idea what that accent is supposed to be either. So don't look at me. Don't look at me. It's the leak. It's the leak. And Sir Kim Darroch resigning as UK ambassador to the United States. It's the leak. It's all they're talking about. Donald Trump is tweeting he's a very stupid guy. You're a very stupid guy. And everybody's tweeting and it's the leak right across the UK media. It's a nothing story. I explained this a million times what it really is. But it's funny. It's funny to watch them talk about it as if it's really serious and as if it might damage the special relationship between the UK and the US. Nothing is going to damage the special relationship between the UK and the US because friends that bomb, maim, cripple and destroy nations together remain together forever. I just made that up on the spot. Special relationship is fine, thank you. Don't worry about it. Madness this, madness. But there was some high comedy today. High comedy. Do you want to hear some of the high comedy? No? You don't? You do? Let's have some of the high comedy. Kay Burley interviewed Michael Fallon. That's Sir Michael Fallon to you, Paddy. I'm not calling anybody, sir. Let alone Michael Fallon. Michael Fallon is a former cabinet secretary and he's a supporter of Boris Johnson. And Kay Burley wanted to go after Michael Fallon because apparently in the debate last night on ITV, the debate hosted by ITV between Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson, allegedly, apparently, because I didn't watch much of it, Johnson threw the ambassador, Kim Darroch, under the bus. And Kay Burley, well, she wanted to do a bit of grandstanding as the ginger ninja. Do you want to hear some of this? Good fun. Kay Burley, Michael Fallon.
Do you think that Boris Johnson should have been more fulsome in his support of his most senior overseas civil servant?
Right, Michael. Should Boris have been more fulsome in his support of the most senior civil servant when he was on ITV last night? Michael Fallon.
Well, Boris Johnson does support all our diplomats wherever they are around the world.
It's not my question, sir. It's not my question. Answer the question, please.
Well, what is the question?
I'll say it again. My question is this. Do you think that Boris Johnson should have been more fulsome in his support of the most senior civil servant overseas?
No, I don't.
Brilliant journalism, Kay.
No, I don't think that would have made the wording he used, I think, don't think would have made any difference to Sir Kim's position, which, as I say, had already become very difficult, probably untenable, from the Monday onwards, well before last night's debate.
So, the leader of the free world fires off these tweets when he first wakes up, is slagging off our man for doing his job, which is exactly what the British government pays him to do. And as a result, he's lost his position, and the man who is ultimately wants to be in number 10 Downing Street could not have done more to support him last night. Is that actually what you're saying?
Is it really your position? Is it really, really what you're saying?
Yes, it is.
Yes! That's the only answer, isn't it? It is, Kay. It is. I will see your silliness and I will raise it. It is my position, says Michael.
It is. I mean, the person who has lost him his job, of course, is the person who leaked this material,
yes,
as the Foreign Office Permanent Secretary
yes,
has just told
indeed.
Our Foreign Affairs Committee. That's the worst breach of trust and leaking of confidential papers that he's ever known.
Well, I don't know about that. The GCSE exams were leaked a couple of weeks ago. I think that was a bit more serious, mind. Right, so Boris Johnson himself, the former Foreign Secretary, the man most likely to be the UK's next Prime Minister, Boris, did a bit of flip-flopping himself, cornered today by the media. What did Boris say about Sir Kim and his resignation?
I just heard that Kim Darroch resigned, and I want to say that I regret that, really, because I think he was a superb diplomat, and I worked with him for many years, and I think that whoever leaked his diptels really has done a grave disservice to our civil servants. It is not right that civil servants' careers and prospects should be dragged into the political agenda, and I think we should be protecting brilliant civil servants from that kind of publicity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nonsense, isn't it? It's nonsense. Here's a more important story, and Julian Petley will be discussing this with me shortly. If you've not heard Julian before, you're in for a treat. Lovely, lovely man. And, well, he's a die-in, really, of journalism. There's not many of them left in this country. Great guy, Julian. Joins me shortly. World leaders, journalists, and other interested parties are in London. Today and tomorrow, it began today for a two-day conference to agree ways to defend media freedom around the world. And the United Kingdom government is even prepared to send overseas aid to promote journalism in far-flung, far reaches of the world. Because journalism is so wonderful in this country, and it's so free, and it's so effective, that we can lecture the world and tell them how to defend media freedom. Of course, the irony here is that RT, which is a credible platform, I would say, that's my personal opinion, and it does some good stuff, and Sputnik, which I have a bit of admiration for as well, Sputnik and RT were banned from a conference that was set up to discuss ways to defend media freedom.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah, let's have a conference to talk about media freedom. Who will we ban first? Okay. Right. It's not good, right? It's not funny either, Rich. I know. I'm giddy. It's all the fumes from the glue. A floor is being glued down yesterday, today and tomorrow. And the fumes of the glue, well, I'm like one of Ka's victims. You know the snake Ka in Disney's The Jungle Book? When Ka looks at people in the eyes, that's my eyes now, they're spinning, you see. That's an incredible story, that. Yes, let's talk about media freedom, and in the meantime, let's ban some of the media. Right. We'll talk more about that with Julian Petley right soon, so we will. Wednesday is Prime Minister's Questions Day at Westminster. I know you know this. Round about midday, May gets to her hoofs. Shuffles to the dispatch box and takes questions from around the house, including Jeremy Corbyn. 'Twas high comedy everywhere today. May and Corbyn were playing "You're a bigger racist than me." Have a listen to some of this. You might hear May first.
He was an anti-racist, now he ignores anti-Semitism.
He ignores it.
He's been a Eurosceptic all his life, now he backs Remain. He's truly living up to the words of Marx. Those are my principles, and if you don't like them, I've got others. Not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coming from the Prime Minister, who created the hostile environment which brought about the Windrush scandal, who ordered go home vans to drive around London, who refuses to acknowledge Islamophobia in her own party, and whose party consorts with racists and anti-Semites in the European Parliament and sucks up to those governments across Europe. We don't need those kind of lectures.
For shame. For shame. Corbyn and May there. Hey, listen, before we talk to Julian about the media freedom thing, let's hear from Polly Boyko. I like Polly. I've swapped a few messages with Polly on Twitter, and I've invited her on the programme. And I think she was all too willing to come on, but her own press office, I don't think, were thrilled about her coming on The Richie Allen Show. That's all right. I like Polly. She's a good reporter for RT. She's outside the Press Media Freedom Conference in London, and she's talking about it in her capacity as a banned RT journalist, Polly Boyko.
Pretty big, around 60 ministers, 1,000 journalists, esteemed members of civil society and academics are all set to attend this inaugural conference on global media freedoms hosted by the UK and the Canadian governments here in London. There's going to be a special guest, Amal Clooney, the international human rights lawyer, also George Clooney's wife. She is the Britain's special envoy on media freedom at this event. Guess who's not a special guest at the event today? Here I am, Billy No Mates, all over again, I have to say, because this has happened before, I will explain. But myself, my fellow RT journalists, also journalists from Sputnik, have all been banned from attending today, ironically, the Global Conference on Media Freedoms. We applied to attend just like everybody else, well in advance. We got an accreditation email back saying, it was a pretty stock reply actually, it said, unfortunately, we're unable to approve your application to accredit as media. Perhaps that should have been a clue. We thought perhaps there's no space. It seemed like a pretty standard response that we'd got. But behind our backs, other news outlets were getting a very different message from the Foreign Office. Yesterday, so the day just before the conference, a variety of media outlets here in the UK started putting out a story saying that RT had been banned, RT and Sputnik. And they got a quote from the Foreign Office explaining why we'd been banned. Take a listen.
We have not accredited RT or Sputnik because of their active role in spreading disinformation. While it's not possible to accommodate all requests for accreditation, journalists from across the world's media are attending the conference, including from Russia.
Yeah, but not RT and not Sputnik. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. It is outrageous. The Angela Merkel thing is interesting, isn't it? Video footage has shown Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, shaking pretty violently again. This is the third time this has happened in the last few weeks. Today she was standing alongside the Finnish Prime Minister. There was a ceremony in Berlin today. After the incident, Merkel said she was very well and there was no need to worry. She's 64, is the Chancellor, and this happened a couple of weeks ago ahead of a trip to Japan, you might remember. She said she was fine, and massive speculation, of course, about that. Alzheimer's, dementia, or any neurological condition like that, of course, isn't funny. And I certainly don't mean to annoy anybody who might be affected by that or who might know somebody. But I'm probably not far wrong with my silly gag about the betting companies taking bets on how long the next episode will last. I mean, they're pretty awful, aren't they, betting companies? I'm sure if you walked into a local betting shop and said, listen, what are the odds on the duration of the next shaking incident involving Angela Merkel, they'll probably give you odds. They give you odds on anything. They'll give you odds on anything. It's approaching 18 minutes past the hour. Hi to Mwinga. By the way, how you doing, Mwinga? Hi to Gail, to Paul Alawi. How you doing, Paul? How you doing, Paul? Paul says, Richie, as you were saying on the paper report earlier, the news has been positioned to appeal to readers of Shite, like Hello Magazine, OK Magazine, reporting on the media conference and mentioning George Clooney's wife. Pretty much echoes that perfectly, says Paul. Yeah. Yeah, Paul. There's no doubt about that. Hi to Faisal. How you doing, Faisal? Hi to Gail. I'll have a look at that petition later on, Gail. I can't read it now. I'll have a look at it later on. And if I like it, I'll retweet it. I'm sure I'll like it. Hi to Charlotte and Burnley. To everybody tweeting the programme this afternoon. Hi to Danny Warden. How you doing, Danny? Hi to Laurie Hatfield. How you doing, Laurie? Thanks for choosing The Richie Allen Show. It is The Richie Allen Show. It is live right now on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester. Triggerwarning.tv, my own website, of course, and plenty of other places. It is on the TuneIn app. It's on the TuneIn app where it has thousands of followers there. A lot of people like the TuneIn app. The wonderful gentleman who's rearranging the entire ground floor of our house, Michael, lovely guy is Mike, is a big fan of the TuneIn app. Doesn't listen to the Richie Allen Show, though. Try and get him sorted by the end of the week. I'm not sure he's into programmes like this, but maybe by the end of the week, maybe. We'll bring him round. All right. We'll bring him round. 20 past the hour. Music, then. Music, right. Okay. It's a scorcher in the studio in Salford in Greater Manchester. Oi. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. Julian Petley joins me in a couple of minutes' time. And if you want to me to put something to Julian, tweet it to me. It's at Richie Allen Show. Welcome to the programme. Blur, Park Life on the Richie Allen Show. 23 minutes past the hour. Hi to Martin in Spain. How you doing, Martin? You well? On the east coast there, the Costa Blanca, I do believe. I do believe. Let's introduce then, let's welcome our first guest to the programme. This is a huge story, this. I mean, it's a massive story. And apart from one or two little bits and bobs in the press this afternoon, in the online versions of the UK newspapers, there hasn't been much focus on it, and it's a big old story. Talked about this at the beginning of the programme. A global conference for media freedom is taking place in London. It began today. It will conclude tomorrow. World leaders, journalists and others have gathered for this conference to consider ways to defend media freedom. It's been reported that the United Kingdom is even prepared to spend money overseas aid to promote press freedom. Is the United Kingdom in any position? Is the government? Is this country in any position to be telling others how to defend media freedom? I don't know. Let's ask my first guest, and somebody I've admired for many years, and he's been speaking on programmes produced by me for a long time. He's a terrific journalist, an honorary professor at Brunel University, freelance journalist, media commentator, and one of the principal editors of the Journal of British Cinema and Television. He's a member of the National Council of the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, and he's written and co-authored some very interesting books like Media and Public Shaming, and recently a book called Culture Wars, The Media and the Left in Britain. It's a pleasure to welcome back to this programme after a bit of an absence, Professor Julian Petley. Julian, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, Richie. I'm fine, thank you very much. And it's very nice to be back with you again.
Thanks for doing it. Your time is valuable and I really appreciate it. Is the United Kingdom... Now, I didn't introduce this by mentioning RT. Talked about this yesterday and Sputnik briefly until I ran into difficulties. Talked about it today. Polly Boyko did a really interesting report for RT outside the conference. Rather ironic to be talking about media freedom and banning media organisations from coming inside and participating. Are we really in any position as a country to be telling people how to defend media freedom, even Julian?
No, in my view, we're not. I don't think we have at all a good record in the UK on media freedom. Not now, and frankly, not ever. And the people who wouldn't allow RT to attend this conference should remember a few things, which is that Orwell said that if freedom means anything at all, it means freedom to be told things you don't want to hear. And Voltaire, allegedly at least, saying, you know, I will defend your right for you to say things that I don't agree with. You can't just have media freedom for people who you think are jolly good chaps and not media freedom for everybody else.
Yeah, it's very fair, this. Lots of tweets. I won't interrupt you with too many references to Twitter, but there's been an enormous response
on. Do, please.
Yeah, Faisal says they might want to mention Julian Assange for a start. Some of these people. The press has been quiet on that front. Andy Newman says RT gets accused of spreading misinformation. Oh, the irony, says Andy. And David Stanford tweets, media freedom means media free of anything but the bull crap of the official narrative. A lot of angry people today.
You know, the thing is, Richie, that I think the Assange thing is really, really important, because many, many British newspapers, papers like The Telegraph, The Sun, The Mail and The Express, thought it was absolutely right that Assange should be shut up in the Ecuadorian embassy, and then when he had to leave there, put in jail. You know, we have newspapers which really do believe that people like Assange, and for that matter Edward Snowden as well, when they speak truth to power, should be silenced. I mean, you know, worse still, when The Guardian splashed the Edward Snowden revelations, papers like The Mail, The Sun, The Express and The Telegraph argued that they should be prosecuted. What the hell kind of press is this that argues that other journalists should be prosecuted because they've done things that the government finds embarrassing or doesn't like? You know, this, in my view, is not journalism. This is anti-journalism.
I described you earlier on, your ears might have been burning, and I meant it. I wasn't kissing your ass. I said you're a doyen, a doyen of journalism in this country. You are. You're brilliant. You've walked the walk.
So.
No, you have. You have, Jude. You've walked the walk as well as talking the talk. How did we get to that position then? How have we gotten to the position where journalists are satisfied that Julian Assange can be extradited to the United States, where he will undoubtedly not be treated properly, where he is undoubtedly... How do we get there?
It's a very, very long story, in my view. I mean, with long historical roots. I mean, I've been a journalist, but I wrote, when I was a full-time journalist, I wrote for the magazine sector, and on the whole, I enjoyed doing that. I've never really done very much stuff for the daily press. So I don't want to, basically. I like The Guardian. I think it's good. I think it is a good liberal newspaper with all the pluses and minuses that comes with a liberal perspective. I like the Financial Times, and you know, I think these are good papers within the kind of liberal theory of journalism. But, you know, an awful lot of British, English, I'm going to say English rather than British, an awful lot of English newspapers, frankly, Richie, have always supported the status quo. I mean, right from the beginning of the popular press in the UK, which we can date to the end of the 1800s, really, an awful lot of those papers have not just simply been conservative supporting newspapers, but more generally, they've been supporters of the status quo. I think in this country that most, not all, of the national press is part of the huge machinery which exists in the UK for preserving the status quo. And I think that as time has gone by, that's become more and more and more pronounced. Why? Because those newspapers which were left of centre, like the News Chronicle or the Daily Herald or Reynolds News and a few others as well, gradually fell by the wayside. They fell by the wayside not because they couldn't attract readers, but because they couldn't attract advertisers, because the advertisers thought that the people who read those papers were not the kind of people who would buy the goods and services that the adverts were pushing. So gradually you've become left with a kind of very, very dominant rightward-leaning press with a kind of liberal rump. And the liberal rump is the Financial Times, the Guardian, Observer, and I would argue the I newspaper as well. But that is a rump. That is a minority. The majority papers are rightward-leaning, and in some cases they're very rightward-leaning.
We talked in the past, you and I, about the difficulties facing the print media, and you were one of the first people to, that on my programme anyway, you were one of the first to see what was going to happen to print media, you know, with what happened to The Independent. The Guardian is struggling very badly now. And I remember you talking to me about that some years ago, very prophetically. Have we begun to see? One of the things discussed on this show quite a lot is social media and how social media is shaping the discourse in terms of how people are finding themselves in echo chambers on social media. They are finding themselves surrounded by that which they want to hear and want to see, rather than a good variety and a good flavour of opinion in general. And I wonder, is that landscape changing the editorial policy subconsciously or consciously at newspapers like the ones we've mentioned?
I don't know, because I think that papers like the... Let's take the Daily Mail, for example.
Yeah.
Those papers have always excelled at telling their readers what those readers want to hear. I mean, there are two different conceptions of journalism. One is that journalism is supposed to inform people and to educate people and to enlighten people. Which, of course, some now that kind of idea is dismissed as elitist by the populists like Farage and Johnson. But the other conception of journalism is, let's just give people what they want. Let's just appeal to popular prejudices, because apart from anything else, that sells newspapers. I think newspapers are very worried that if they tell people what they don't want to hear or are not interested in, then newspaper sales will fall even quicker, by the way, than they're falling already. And it is encouraging, in my view at least, that in this unpleasant environment, that papers like The Guardian, through their online existence, are actually getting a bigger and bigger and bigger readership. Because whatever the shortcomings of liberal newspapers may be, and I do admit that there are shortcomings, it is surely preferable to the kind of garbage pumped out by papers like The Telegraph, Sun, Mail and Express, which is shocking. I mean, it's not even journalism, in my view.
Some of our listeners now, they want to pick you up on the Guardian point. Some of our listeners are saying, and the tweets are there for people to see them. I'm not inventing the tweets, they're there. Some of them are saying, enjoying this chat, but The Guardian has gone the way of the other papers in terms of its output, whether Julian, you know, wants to accept that or not. And one listener has tweeted, it does once in a while have a really good story, The Guardian, investigative journalism, but it's like they immediately then print a dozen pages of propaganda to make up for it. Why is The Guardian any different in terms of giving its readers what it wants, what its readers, because its readers presumably would be Labour Party supporters historically, they would reject...
Well, I would say the people who read The Guardian would be people who are, let's put it broadly, left of centre.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the problem for a lot of people is The Guardian isn't left-wing enough. And part of me would agree with that. But... I read The Guardian regularly, and I personally think that people like some of their columnists in particular, like George Monbiot, Aditya Chakraborty, those two in particular, Afua Hirsch, I think, are people who are putting forward points of view which, at least in terms of the British press, are quite a long way to the left. I mean, we could all agree, listen, I would happily agree with people who are tweeting in that we could do with a properly left-wing newspaper, like, for example, Libération in France, but we haven't got one. And the only attempt to set up a left-wing newspaper, which was News on Sunday, I mean, it did fail very, very badly, to be said. So I will settle for a liberal newspaper with all the shortcomings of liberalism, which I don't need to be reminded about, because I still think that that is preferable to the right-wing populism, which pours out of papers like the Telegraph, Mail, Express and Sun, and the Times, by the way.
Can I argue with this point? Let me, because this is brilliant, it's really fascinating. Let me remind our listeners, an old friend and somebody I respect greatly, Julian Petley, is live on the line today. It's great to have Julian back on the programme. And we're talking about, initially, the conference in London that wants to discuss how to improve press freedom overseas, and it banned RT and it banned Sputnik. We've segued into what is happening in the UK, and it's very interesting. Look, my politics are definitely very, very, very left of centre. They always have been. And I would argue that when I was a teenager, I'm 44 now, when I was a teenager in high school and then when I went into third level education, people on the very left, on the far left, as I suppose I would be, were people who loved an argument, loved a debate, and didn't mind getting down in the trenches with anybody. What I see in The Guardian, and I used to be a big fan of The Guardian many years ago, I still read it, obviously, I read everything, as you do, Julian. What I see today increasingly are people either writing for The Guardian or are working around The Guardian, and they are the first people to demand that people be silenced or shut down. The Guardian has been very supportive of things like no platforming people and stuff like that. And that really worries me, because to me that's giving a kind of a false impression of what the left is. We used to be on the left the greatest arguers, the greatest fighters for debate. And now it seems that, you know, I've got the same problems you have with the right-wing media. It bothers me as much as it bothers you. I really do mean that. But if they've got one thing going for them, at least they're not calling people to be banned because of their opinions or silenced. It's Guardian readers on Twitter demanding that people are deleted and silenced and stuff like that. That's the argument I'm going to make, Julian. I'm going to shut up. Over to you.
But that's the problem with liberalism, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I do not believe in shutting people down. And by the way, The Guardian has for quite a long time run arguments about, oh, we mustn't have this kind of pornography or that kind of pornography, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay, there are problems with pornography, but the problem with arguments for banning pornography is that when these people get their way, all sorts of other things get banned as well, like, for example, safe sex advice or sex education advice, because once you start putting legislation on the statute book, which enables you to start banning things, it's almost always abused. You might start off with the best possible motives and you want nasty stuff and bullying stuff and harassment stuff banned. But once you put these laws on the statute books, which allow you to ban stuff which some people find offensive and bloody blah, it's almost always misused. You cannot trust the police and people like the Internet Watch Foundation or the Crown Prosecution Service to behave responsibly. That is, I mean, with regard to freedom of speech, once they've got laws that they can use to shut stuff down. So people who, you know, campaign against pornography, however much they dislike pornography, I'm afraid are very often lending themselves to having legislation put on the statute books, which may well ban things or be used to ban things that they themselves don't want banned.
Yeah, I can't add to that. Murray says The Guardian once was a left-leaning newspaper. Now it's monumental. And he says, bollocks, we can say that here. We get away with that. That's just his opinion.
I'm not sure it was ever left-leaning. I repeat my point that I think that it is a liberal newspaper. And I say, with all the... I mean, there are good things about liberalism, don't get me wrong, but there are plenty of bad things about liberalism too. I personally, in recent years, have seen what you might call the commentariat on the Guardian, the people I've mentioned already, people like Chakraborty and
George,
Matthew Hirsch and co. I think they're pretty sharp. I think that I know some people don't think that George Monbiot is left wing enough, but I personally find his views on, for example, land reform to be extremely compelling.
Which is an issue that I'm determined to get into on this particular programme.
It's
because it's very interesting you bring that up. Julian,
and you look at the attacks which have been launched on Monbiot by, again, this awful triumvirate of The Sun, The Telegraph, The Mail and The Express. But the kind of, I think, quite modest proposals that Monbiot and others have put forward have been condemned by the right as, you know, virtually as communist.
Once upon a time,
insane.
Julian. It's insane. Once upon a time in Ireland, we had Gay Byrne. Gay is still alive, of course. Gay presented the Late Late Show on Friday nights for about 50
years. Yeah, I remember.
You remember Gay. And one of the beautiful, one of the wonderful things about the Late Late Show was the lengthy interviews, but particularly the last segment on the Late Late Show was always a 35 or 40 minute debate about things like this. This is sadly lacking today. It's brilliant you bringing up George's land reform articles, because those guys on the right or whatever spectrum they're on, we should have that debate in public in a intellectual way.
But the trouble is that many of these people don't want to debate. That's one of the problems. Yeah. You and I have talked a lot about the importance of debate. In your programme and the programmes that you've been on before this one, have always given people who want to debate real space to do so. And that's very, very, very rare in this media environment where, you know, if you're lucky, you get 2 minutes on the BBC.
Yeah.
So that's why I really value what you do. But the idea that these people want to debate, in my view, is mistaken. You talked earlier on about the echo chamber. They only ever want to go into newspapers or onto websites or whatever with which they agree. They don't want to engage in debate with people who, A, don't agree with them, and B, may well be more knowledgeable than they are. You've only got to look at what happens when, you know, Nigel Lawson was challenged on climate disaster, for example, to see that really he knew so all about it.
He had a series of absolutes. Yeah, you're going to want to murder me. I've got a bit of sympathy with Jeremy Corbyn's brother Piers about the climate thing. I'm you'll call me a climate denier, but personally,
no, because Jeremy Corbyn is not the same.
No, I know
as,
he's not.
As Lawson.
No, I know that. No, I've got great. I'm a big skeptic of the claim that CO2 is driving climate. I'm a huge skeptic of it, not because I'm, you know, because I want to be, because I just want to, you know, because I want to dismiss it, but I've heard from, you know, credible scientists and geologists who disputed. In fact, I had an academic on from a university in this country last week talking about it. But anyway, but I agree with you. Lawson's performance, speaking in a series of absolutes and not really understanding the science. But I don't believe that the debate on climate change has been shut down. But it's a very interesting one, and it endorses your point. That's one where, I mean, I saw Piers Corbyn, Jeremy's brother, who is a meteorologist and is a scientist. And he was brought onto the BBC about 2 years ago by Nicky Campbell on The Big Questions on Sunday morning. And he was interrupted, he was ridiculed, he was mocked and laughed at, even by the host, Nicky Campbell himself. And I thought, that's pretty dreadful, that.
But that shouldn't happen.
It should never happen.
I mean, he has a point of view, and it's an informed point of view, and it should be listened to.
Yeah, end of story, full stop, no matter what the issue is. I totally agree with that. Loads of tweets on this. Thanks for the tweets. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. You can follow Julian on Twitter as well. By the way, I'll tweet out a link to where you can follow him there. Keep those tweets coming in. Hugely interesting, this. My granny used to read The Observer on a Sunday, says one listener. She was a communist. She will be spinning in her grave now at what The Observer has become. I can't speak to that because I wouldn't have read The Observer when his granny was reading it, but so I can't comment on it. Maybe you've got a comment on that, Julian, on how The Observer has changed.
Well,
editorially,
The Observer has been owned by some fairly dubious people, like Tiny Rowland, for example, who certainly used The Observer to advance his own business interests, particularly his mining interests in Africa. You know, we are not going to get perfection, in my view, but I still value some of the work that they've done. For example, when just take one example, when Paul Lashmar and David Lee exposed the fact that MI5 were operating a blacklist for the BBC allegedly left-wing journalists who the BBC shouldn't and wouldn't employ. That
Brilliant.
Strikes me as a very, very useful piece of work.
Great story. And also the work they've done on Cambridge Analytica. And
absolutely.
The
now,
brilliant
that is
stuff.
Extremely important.
Yeah, and I
look
kind
how
of...
how that's
yeah.
been... That's not only been ignored by most of the rest of the mainstream media, but trashed. I mean, I think someone be really good to get on your show would be Carol Cadwallader,
yeah,
who
Carol,
I admire enormously, I have to say.
Yeah, we reached out to Carol and others, but, you know, look, you and I have had a couple of private conversations. There are some people who won't come on the programme, only because I've had other people on that they think I shouldn't have had on,
well,
which really annoys
me. Well, I know,
me.
Because we shouldn't ignore the fact that there is quite a lot of animosity against you personally and against the programme. I've also encountered this, and this is all part, in my view, of the strategy by the elements of the mainstream media, particularly the right-wing elements of the mainstream media, to try to discredit alternative voices.
Yeah, and look, I've had some fruitcakes on the programme that have said some outlandish things, right? And you know this. I mean, you came to see us in London, and we chatted when we were doing the TV, and we all sorts of people with all sorts of very interesting and very far-out points of view. But the nice thing about all of that is you get to speak to them, you get to tell them, well, look, I don't really agree with that, I don't see it that way, but they're happy that somebody has listened to them and that they can have a chat about it and get their point of view out there.
The thing is, you get to interrogate them. That's the purpose of journalism, really, is to interrogate people with, you know, whatever views they have. You get them on the television or on the radio or whatever, and you get a chance to question them, whereas papers like The Mail and The Telegraph do no such thing. They get people on that they completely agree with, and then they spend the rest of the pagination trashing people they don't agree with.
Yeah, I know, I do go further, because I see that destroying the old left media as well, and I'm not just trying to be the devil's advocate here, I really do believe that. I see it every, and you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Julian, was there's been some excellent reporting done by various some excellent papers written by academics, but by doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists of late, about, again, I want to go back just briefly to social media and how powerful it has become. I mean, Facebook now, 1.5 billion, nearly 2 billion users. And Facebook uses algorithms to decide what people see on their timelines and what they don't see. This is unbelievable. And we don't talk about this enough. And what it's doing to people is, it's making people more entrenched in their own point of view. And people like me and you, and I'm not bigging us up. I mean, I really am a curmudgeonly, narky Irish bastard at times. I am. But I am, Julian. But what I am not is I'm not entrenched in my political opinions. I am not. I love hearing from people who say, Richie, you're wrong. I'll tell you why you're wrong, Richie. That's my favourite sentence in the world. I'll tell you why you're wrong. Marvellous. But I think the social media age and where this is going to lead, I think it's going to lead to a very different type of person, human being, who is going to be increasingly incapable or unable to deal with others who think differently than them. And that's dangerous, Julian, for humanity, that is.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I fear you may be right, but I think that the whole problem, really, with social media and with the internet in general is that it's a Janus faced thing. On the one hand, it's never been easier to come across all sorts of different kinds of information and all sorts of different kinds of points of view with yeah. which you may or may not agree, and that to me is absolutely wonderful. I think it's a great thing.
But doesn't let me sorry to interrupt you, Julian. I hate to interrupt you of all people. But doesn't Twitter and Facebook first of all, you're 100% right. It's brilliant. It's out there if you want it. But don't the social media companies change people to the point of view where they dismiss that which doesn't, you know, compute with what they feel, and they block it. In fact, they block it, and they end up with groups and identity groups where it's all pretty much what they're getting is pretty much what they want to read or hear.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't have to be directed by Twitter or Facebook. If you're an independent-minded person who knows how the whole system operates, you can navigate around that. I think that the whole problem is that many people don't understand how it works, and the dangers that you talk about of people living in echo chambers and bubbles is a very real danger. But the same danger would apply, though, if somebody only ever read the Daily Mail and said, well, that's where I, you know, that those are the views I agree with, and that's all I'm going to read, and that's that. And that, you know, has been the case in the past. I mean, now the readership of newspapers mostly is going down. So I think what my point here really would be that people need to be educated into how best to make the most of the great opportunities offered by social media and the internet in general. You know, it can be hell or it can be heaven, and I think people need to be able to appreciate and access the good aspects of it, and by good I mean mind broadening, experience widening aspects of the internet, rather than the kind of the shutting down of the universe of discourse which far too much of the internet encourages. But you know, this would bring us back to talking about the need for proper media education in schools, and
yeah.
proper media literacy, and teaching people how to make the best of all of this.
I wish they brought back debating teams in schools.
God, yes. Well, I've actually been involved in this, because one of the things that I have been involved with is a project funded by the Open Society Institutes called Knowing Our Rights, which is an attempt to try to enlighten people about what human rights actually are, and to try to counteract the utter crap talked in the right-wing press about human rights. And we've done debating events in schools up and down the country, and it's been really, really good, because apart from anything else, it's been very, very encouraging to realize how knowledgeable young people actually are, and to realize they haven't swallowed all the nonsense talked
that's
about
really
in the right wing press.
Do you know what, that's really encouraging. That's a wonderful thing. I remember being a member of a debating team when I was in second year in Ireland, and I remember the teacher who led it, a teacher called Derek Casey from Cork, lovely man, Derek, and he introduced me to the concept of trying to understand why people think the way they do. And it was a big shock to me to be told we're going to have a debate today about the future of Ireland and Ireland being one nation again. And I had to take the opposing, so I had to take the side of the loyalists. And that was an amazing thing, you know, as a Republican, as a young Irish Republican with, you know, full of crap as I was with ideas. And he said, well, you're going to be taking the point of view that the country should never be united. And you're going to make a very cogent argument about that. Go away and research it. Drove me mad, you know. But I did it. And I enjoyed it. And I began to start to see other people, not as horrible people because they disagreed with me, but just as human beings who came to their points of view as they did because that's the way they are. And that's the way I am.
It is very, very important to understand why people think the way they do. I mean, I think it's too easy to dismiss people with whom one doesn't agree as stupid or blinkered. And a lot of that has gone on around Brexit, for example. Oh, these people must be thick. It's actually really important to understand why it is that people have the ideas that they have, particularly if you, have the desire to change those ideas. It's no good telling people that they're stupid. You might tell them politely that they're misinformed. That's not the same thing as stupid at all. But you do need to understand why it is that people have the ideas that they have.
And the only way we'll do that is by regularly meeting with people, speaking to them, listening to them. Listening is the greatest skill. You know, as a journalist, better than anybody. I mean, I did some brief work for City and Guilds and Fos Ireland, where I was introducing radio production to 16 and 17 year olds, and I used to bang on because my old lecturers used to bang on to me, the greatest muscle you have is the one between your ears, or the greatest muscle you have is your ear, are your ears. Listen to people. Get sweaty while you're listening. Actually get sweaty, you perspire, listen to what they're saying, and then answer back. 2 minutes to the top of the hour, Julian. We've got Julian for two more minutes. It's been fascinating having you back on, Julian. You should come back on more often. And I know I've said this in the past, don't wait to be invited on. You've always got things to say, and you know, drop us a line and come on.
See,
this is an independent operation. I am the chief cook and bottle washer here. I produce, edit, present, get it on YouTube, get it on iTunes. I do all of that. So do come back. So you're optimistic. I'm going to give you the final word. Thanks, Julian. I'll give you the final word. You're optimistic. I'm a doom and gloom merchant. I think we're screwed in terms of the media, but it's not all as bad as I think it is.
Well, I'm not that optimistic. I think that there are definitely positive possibilities, but there are some very, very negative ones as well. And in the end, and this may be an unpopular thing to say, I do think there needs to be a degree of regulation, not in the sense of censorship or banning things, but somehow or other, diversity has to be regulated into the system. That, to me, is the most important lesson that I have learned, that censorship on the whole is a bad thing, but not all regulation is censorship. And I think that regulations which can try to regulate diversity, accountability, the public interest into the media, whichever media they are, can only be a good thing.
Julian, come back anytime. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it. Hugely important. And next time you come on, we'll talk about regulation, because I'm inclined to agree with you, but I'd be very worried at the same time. But I know where you're going with that. That would be a great topic for... In fact, I'll get a journalist on. You know, there are still some journalists in the print media today who will come on. I'll get one or two on who might take a different point of view to you.
Yeah.
And we'll have a good bash at it for 35 or 40 minutes. That'd be
great.
Good. Julian, you're a legend, mate. Thanks for coming on. Love having you on. I really mean that. Look after yourself.
And you too. Bye-bye.
The brilliant Professor Julian Petley, live on The Richie Allen Show. It is, of course, Wednesday, July 10th, 2019. Great to have him back on the programme, Julian. Good to trigger some of you as well. No harm in that, eh? Good to trigger some of you as well, who take a different point of view than Julian. Right, we're going to be speaking with Neil Saunders and Richard Willett in a few minutes' time. We'll be talking about a brand new film about hypnosis and how it is used on society, on me, on thee, on our friends, our family. It's terrific stuff. This is an area of research that I love hearing about. I really do. And we've had Neil on before, Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com, terrific guy, great journalist, a great writer. And Richard Willett is a really interesting guy, connected with Richard on Twitter, and I've been having a bit of a look into his background. He's the director of this brand new film, which will be released in September, and it is called Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. Okay, and it's presented, the film is presented by the renowned stage hypnotist and hypnotherapist Jonathan Royal. And Jonathan, I think, is in Rochdale. He's not far from me. So this is, there's a local flavour to this, but it's an issue that is huge. It is huge, this whole area of mind control and mass global hypnosis. It isn't conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy fact. We're going to have some music from the Lighthouse family. Love this, a song called Lifted. Thanks again to Julian Petley coming on. Very senior, very brilliant journalist, this guy. Love having him on. Big champion of free speech. We love guys like that. Lighthouse family, Neil Saunders, Richard Willett. Follow this on your Richie Allen Show. The time is 6 o'clock. Yeah, the Lighthouse family on the Richie Allen Show. 3.5, nearly 4 minutes past 6. It is Wednesday, the 10th of July, 2019. Broadcasting right now on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester. Tune in radio. Trigger warning, of course, and richieallen.co.uk. Great to be with you this Wednesday. Right, let's move on. Very excited about this, I'm telling you. This is a subject that I love reading about and hearing about. Mass mind control and global hypnosis programs. There is a new film. It's just been completed and it'll be released in September in cinemas and theatres, limited in the UK, and it'll be available on various video on demand platforms as well. It's been produced by Brick in the Wall Media, and it's called Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, bringing to light the way the public is being mind controlled and hypnotised daily. The topics covered in the film include religion, the Illuminati, conflicts, wars in society, the current political climate, 5G, everything you can think of. It's presented, the film, by the British hypnotist Jonathan Royal, whom I mentioned a couple of minutes ago. I can't wait to talk about the film. We're joined this afternoon, this evening, by the director, Richard Willett, and by Neil Saunders. Neil is a contributor to the film, and we know Neil. We've had him on the programme before. Richard and Neil, welcome to the programme. Welcome back, Neil. How you doing, pal? And Richard, you're very welcome, mate. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Cheers.
Good to have you on.
Very much, Richie.
How you doing, Neil? Good stuff. Richard, first to you. You've directed it. Can't wait to see it in September. I've given a very brief synopsis there about the film. I've watched the trailer, which is really, really cool. I've tweeted that. I urge people to go and watch it. Tell us about the film, Richard. Why this film? Why have you directed it? What got you interested in this subject matter?
Thank you for having us on, Richard. I've been around this sort of content for about 10 years now, kind of in and out. And I wanted to sort of look at a film that pointed out the consistencies in techniques of mind control and in consistencies in techniques of people understanding that these same sort of things are being done to you throughout different types of areas of your life. So I was speaking to Jonathan Royal. I knew Neil. We spoke, I think we did a podcast a couple of years ago and we kept speaking since. And we wanted to put a film together that covered all these different areas. And it's been a bit of a marathon to cover all these different areas, but the themes are the same, that they use kind of trauma bonding and trauma bonding mind control to kind of get you in a fight and flight sort of position when then they can just pummel you with these ideas. And we wanted to work with someone like Jonathan, who's a stage hypnotist for many, many years now, who understands how this is done. And obviously Neil as well is a hypnotist. So we thought, let's put a film together and let's try and cover as many topics as we possibly can. And my background, I've got an honours degree in film and TV production. And I kind of shied away from the mainstream media because they wouldn't have me, basically, and not to be able to talk to talk on these topics that you do, Rich, and that Neil does.
Yeah, you couldn't do what you want to do within commercial and national media, so you got to go and do it. By the way, your podcast is brilliant, by the way. I'm not just saying that. I've been listening, and I'm going to put links out to it. It's great. It's lovely to hear something new. I know you've been doing it, and I know you've got a great following, but shamefully, it's fairly new to me, but I like it, and I'm going to be listening to it more. Neil, welcome back, mate. Great to hear Richard there. You introduced me to the concept that Richard just talked about, the fight or flight. Get people into a state of discombobulation, but seriously, into a state of distress, whether subconsciously or consciously, and they become more suggestible, Neil.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's two sort of things that work in that sort of mechanism. One is just simply to get people frightened by everything. You know, that could range from just sort of aspirational, existential, societal worries to am I getting a bit fat? To, oh my God, there's a terrorist coming at me with a knife or something like that. And the suggestion is, well, it's not a suggestion because they've essentially admitted to it, that it's very useful for the people at the top echelons of society to keep people constantly under pressure and under a certain amount of trauma, because as Richard says, basically, it prevents you from being able to critically analyze things. You need a response really quickly. When you're in a fight, say there's a bull charging at you, you need to either sort of kill it or get out of the way. You haven't got time to sit there and think, well, if we wonder about the way the bulls behave, you know, you need to react. And that's the sort of, that's the mind frame that people want, or that those in control want you to be in all the time. And the second sort of mechanism that helps this along is that basically people seek comfort in groups, perfectly sensibly. You know, it's an instinctual drive. If there's more of you, you're more likely to survive, particularly against another gang, say, or something like that. And we all have those sort of innate instinctual drives within us. And again, if you can play on those and drive people into groups, essentially what can happen is that an individual within a group becomes, it is called de-individuation, where essentially you take on board the aspects of the group as a whole. And this is why basically people get swept up in riots, or, you know, very sensible kids all of a sudden start burning things down at Glastonbury or whatever, because basically everyone else is doing it and you feel that you can get away with it because you're part of a group, so you're less likely to get caught, essentially.
Yeah, this is a really interesting concept. Richard, listen to Neil there. I don't want to segue because I want to talk about the film and the themes within it. But, you know, you think of, obviously, the rise of, if there is a rise, the rise of more, we've seen it in the past, but lately there's a kind of a new, kind of a far-right element on the rise in the country. And it's led by, you know, various characters. Obviously, the one most obvious one is Tommy Robinson. Stephen Yaxley Lennon will be sentenced tomorrow, I believe, in London. We don't have to go into any of that, but you see more and more people maybe perplexed, Richard, about why they're poor, why they don't have access to good jobs, and they gravitate towards figures like Robinson and others, and this is what we're talking about here, right? This is an aspect of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think what's happened is over the years, people have just been absolutely, they call it in narcissism, you've been basically abused by someone with a personality disorder, which is the elite. So you've been abused, you've been gaslit, you're in a state of being in an abusive relationship, and it's generational. So I think what it's come to now, I mean, something like Brexit is clearly a complete mess on purpose. People don't know what's going on left, right. And also there's this understanding of, it's almost like this left, right paradigm is almost like your daddy and your mummy. If your daddy's bad, you go to your mummy. If your mummy's bad, you go to your daddy. But what about if both of them are bad? Yeah. What do you do? And that's the point, is that both of them are bad. And that's what people don't seem to understand, is that this has been done on purpose. And the film trying to kind of points out is, look, these are the signs that you're being abused. So, yeah, we're all in a state of being abuse victims, I think, over a long period of time. Our parents are, grandparents are, grandparents are. And if it doesn't stop now, it will be our grandchildren. And that's part of what the film is. We're in a state of, I believe, almost like an emotional breakdown on a global scale, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. A question for both of you. I have a theory that you can shoot right down, and it is that I think it's sometime in the early to mid-2000s, I think this manipulation, this massive mind control that you guys talk about and that Neil has written about, I think maybe it was less effective, or there seemed to be a more, there seemed to be an understanding creeping into society amongst people that mummy and daddy, as you brilliantly described there, are very bad. And I wonder, yes. Question to both of you, did this programme that you explore in the film, did that get ramped up around the time of the mid to late 2000s? Or am I talking nonsense? Has it just always been on?
Well, I think it was ramped up, to be quite honest, because as you say, there was a huge feeling of disenfranchisement with people and suspicion of the elites and suspicion of government. But that was utilised very, very recently by characters like Tommy Robinson, like Donald Trump, like Nigel Farage, yeah. who use that to proclaim themselves to be anti-establishment when they're not.
No.
They're very much not. In fact, you know, if you look at, say, Cambridge Analytica, Heritage Foundation, stuff like that, they've got intimate connections to the CIA and MI5. This is part of a mass program. But what they've done is they've offered you a few things. They've said, we've recognised your problem, and they've offered you an out for it. They've basically said it's not your fault. It isn't your fault, but basically what has happened before is people have been led to believe that it's your fault that you're in this situation. Well, now we've got a group of people who've come along and said, it's not your fault. The problem is that the people that they're pointing at, it's not their fault either.
Yeah,
they're pointing at another small group, a group that is sufficiently scary and weird enough for us to know just enough about them to be frightened, but they aren't quite large enough to have a platform to, you know, argue back and make their case. And what they've done is they've deflected the blame onto this other group, which is a lot easier psychologically. It's a lot easier for us to go, oh, yeah, I could kick his ass. I'm going to kick his ass, rather than going, OK, so Mike Tyson wants to extort me. That's tricky. And then the other thing that they do is that they've appealed to this thing called the mythic past, which is this idea that it was all right a while ago. We don't quite know where it's lost the way, but it used to be fine. Do you remember? Do you remember when it used to be fine? And everyone goes, yeah. But there is a problem with that as well. There's a very famous experiment called I think it's called the Ferris wheel experiment. Essentially, you get five people in a room and you talk to them about a memory that they had whereby they were at a fun fair and they went on a Ferris wheel. Now, this is a completely invented memory, but if you have the right skills and inflection and you can reinforce that over time, the way the human brain works, they will start to incorporate that into the creative aspect of the brain. And essentially, it'll get melded together with real memories. And a surprising amount of people will go, oh, yeah, no, I vividly remember when I was on the Ferris wheel, even though that was a completely invented scenario.
Even though it never happened.
Mm.
And, yeah, you got into this last time we spoke, this particular theory, and I found it fascinating. Because, yes, we do romanticise the past. And I've often wondered, how did I come to romanticise the past? Why do I, you know, pine for days of nostalgia? Why do I think about, you know, when my granddad was going to work and how things must have been so much better? Well, they weren't, obviously, patently, but I have an inherent feeling or belief that they were so much better. And well, you've got me thinking there, you know.
To an extent, it was simpler because you were younger.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I've been having a chat with a guy recently. He was like, oh, it was just so much simpler when I was 20. It's like, that's because you were 20. Like, and you didn't have any responsibilities and the world seemed to go on forever. And terribly important, like, or, you know, things that weren't actually that important seemed important. And now, in retrospect, you've got massive problems like kids and mortgages and jobs and you understand more about the mechanisms of the world. And so it presses on you a bit more.
Yeah,
I also think it's a little bit that, you're not in the now. So you're not here. You're anywhere but now. So if in the past, at least you're not now. And in the future, at least it's not now. And it makes it somewhere else to be more important. And you can't do anything about that. But it's escape. It's like going on holidays, going, oh, well, if I was off in Ibiza, I'd feel better. But you know that when you get to Ibiza, you're still a miserable old sod when you get there.
I think, again, that's all exacerbated by the sort of transitory nature of society at the minute. You know, instant this, apps, social media, like this. How many likes have you got? How many stars does this get? And like, the pace of life. I mean, that is essentially, again, that's a Tavistock sort of thing. It's called future shock. It's too much change happening at in too short a period of time. And by mysterious coincidence, like people from the Tavistock Institute, like Eric Trist and Kirk Lewin, said that, well, yeah, we're doing this on purpose because it basically makes society more malleable.
You won't be surprised, we've loads of tweets. I'm going to read out a couple. Before we do, let me remind the listeners, we have Richard Willett. Richard is a journalist and a filmmaker, and he's directed Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. And it's a film coming out in September in cinema and theatre here, limited in the UK, but also on video on demand. I can't wait to see it. The trailer is excellent. These are important topics, how the public is mind-controlled and hypnotised daily. It's multifaceted how this happens. It's not just through the media, TV, radio, billboards. It's multifaceted. And the filmmakers and Neil, the contributor, have delved into this. I think it's cutting-edge research, this. It really is important, because I think if you begin to understand this, as I'm only beginning to understand it, I think you can work with it and you don't need to fear it. You can see through it and you can move through it and move on beyond it and grow, and you can help others do the same thing. The film is presented by Jonathan Ryle, the hypnotherapist, who's based in Rochdale, I believe. I know I'm connected to Jonathan. We must get him on the programme in the very near future. Richard, I want to talk about, because of your experiences and you not being able to get to do what you would like to do, because this is cutting edge stuff in the mainstream media. I wanted to talk about, I suppose, films. You know, what we see in the cinema today. We've got multiplexes today. That's a whole other issue we could talk about. Often 3 and 4 cinemas showing the same film. Film and entertainment in film and Hollywood productions. How is this agenda moving through the films that we could expect to go and see this coming weekend in a local cineplex?
Well, I think it's quite been apparent for a very long time that these ideas have been put out to test what I think is caused twofold. It's to test your reaction and also get you used to sort of things like Satanism, which are this Epstein things coming out, and it's clearly that there's this global world trafficking child abuse thing that's been exposed by someone like David Icke since the mid-90s. I mean, this is not new to people who research this stuff. So there's that element of it. There's obviously all of this Satanism in the films, in the music industry, people wandering around with covering up one eye, and we've got Miley Cyrus doing all sorts of weird stuff, Lady Gaga drinking blood and doing sacraments.
Let me be the devil's advocate, shows. Richard, hang on just 1 second. Let me be the devil's advocate, right? Because sure. I saw the trailer. I know you've interviewed Gareth Icke about this, and I'm very fond of Gareth. I know Gareth, obviously, and I love this. Now, some of our listeners will go, right, the videos, they're just cool costumes. Putting the hand over the eye, give me a break. What's that? It's just a silly thing to do. The two fingers extended on each hand, the old horns. We watch Iron Maiden on YouTube, and the fans are all giving it the devil's horns. It's just a thing they do. What sort of symbolism could it really mean, and how could it impact on anybody, Richard?
Well, absolutely. It is if you don't know what it's there for. But it also, if two people understand the signifier between the two people, it's a communicative device. Right. So it doesn't really matter whether they're doing it and they don't know what they're doing. Most of them will or be told to do this. I worked on a documentary a few years back. It never came to light, with Brian Harvey, who used to be in E17. And he would tell me about some of the things they'd put in their music videos. And looking back on it, it's clear that he was spot on about this, regardless of what you might think of him as a person.
Oh, Brian's all right. Yeah, he was perplexed, was he, looking back at the videos? He was like, what the hell was that about? Right.
And he's in it. I mean, there's all sorts of people around him at that time. And I mean, that's a completely different story. But this symbolism is there for people to acknowledge between them. I mean, this is a coded language that we're not supposed to understand. That's the point. So, yes, it can be artistic. Some people are going to do it just to trying to look cool or fit in. Or even my 8-year-old nephew mentioned the Illuminati 2 years ago. It completely baffled me how he even knew that was. And it was kind of a joke, but that's the point. So of course it's going to be used, but it doesn't really matter because it's an in language. I think Neil will know much more about this than I will. From what my research shows, is that these symbols go way, way back, thousands of years. They're not anything new. They're used across the board. They're used as signifiers, a wink and a nod, like the Freemasons, to show that I'm in the gang, or this person who's in the music video, whose record deal has been paid for, is part of, or will do as I tell them to, because that's what the game is. This thing is huge, this network. This isn't just music, film. This thing goes, it's the real world, well, the real world wide web, as far as I'm concerned, this conspiracy and this lie and this thing that's been around probably since the late 1700s.
Yeah, do you want to come in? Thanks, Richard. Do you want to come in the symbolism, Neil? Because I remember speaking to David Icke years ago, and David would echo, I think, what Richard just said. But I think David said something to me about these symbols. He would agree with Richard. It's a language. It's an unspoken language. It's a communication device. But even for the innocents, and let's say we're not innocent. We're three guys. We rough and tumble with everybody else. We've got our good points and our bad points. But in terms of this, we're innocent. We're decent guys. It does have an impact on us. It does have an impact on the viewer. And I think David said to me some years ago, these symbols, they make a sound, whether you can hear it or not. It is having some impact on the viewer. Neil.
Well, I mean, the thing is that you're quite right and to play devil's advocate, because essentially the waters have been incredibly muddied since sort of the advent of YouTube and such like that, because people started pointing this out.
Yeah.
And so people started putting symbols in their videos as a way to either be edgy or to get a secondary market, which is very, very, you know, complicating. What is more interesting is looking at the sort of people like, you know, people within the industry like Noriega and... things that Prince has said, perhaps things that Bob Dylan said, and you know, a lot of people have said things that Cat Williams has said and stuff like that seem to support this theory, because you can't deny that there is a running theme that goes through it.
Give us an example now. You mentioned Bob Dylan and some of those. What sort of hints did they give over the years?
Bob Dylan said something along the lines of basically he made a deal with the great commander in chief of the entire universe and the next or something, but he did it in such a way that it didn't seem like he was joking, or he's got the driest sense of humour in the world. But there is a second aspect of this, though. Essentially, it's the immersive aspect of cinema, because essentially a lot of cinema is an advert. It's an advert for the military, or it's an advert for lifestyle, or it's an advert for what would be called manufacturing consent, which is essentially like, if we can set the norms of what everyone says is right and wrong in society, then, you know, we're the arbiters, we're the referees. Now, as some people know, I'm a hypnotherapist, and a lot of people, when they come to you, they're really worried that I don't think that I'll be able to be put under. I don't think you'll be able to hypnotize me. So I always say to them, as I was taught, have you ever cried at a film? And they'll usually say yes. And say, okay, well, then you can be hypnotized, because what you've done there is you've allowed yourself, you know, it's not real. You've allowed the emotion and the immersive sensations of the situation to override your rational thinking capacity, and you're acting on a purely emotional level. And then the second thing that I would say to them is, don't worry, because I don't hypnotize you anyway. What I do is I provide the relaxing circumstances that allow you to put yourself or lower yourself into hypnosis, because you don't hypnotize people. You provide the distraction and the relaxation techniques to basically lower their brainwave activity in such a way that basically you bypass their critical analysis and you speak directly to the subconscious. And this is why people fall asleep watching television. It's not because of the flicker rate, as some people think. It's because of the learned action, the learned repetitive action of sitting down and interacting. And, you know, you also associate it with relaxation, and you start to sort of not focus on it and drift off. And the noise just starts to be a burble in the background, and before you know it, you're asleep. And that's why so many adverts are very, very bizarre, because they know that when you're watching television, you're usually in that sort of lower brainwave state. And so essentially all you need to do is you need to associate something positive with a product, like a beautiful girl an aspirational lifestyle or something like that. And then you put the product next to it. It's very much like Bill Hicks said, you know, two fingers right there and she just says, drink Coke. That would work. We've seen adverts that are actually remarkably similar to that.
This is fascinating. Paul says the penny is dropped. Richard is one of the co-directors of the documentary that explores narcissism and the addiction to social media. Is that right, Richard? It is, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's plugged in, the true toxicity plugged of social media. It's hard to say.
I'm going to make a note of this. This is really good stuff. You've really engaged the audience tonight. Neil Saunders and Richard Willett are our guests. Richard has directed this new film. We will put links out to the trailer again, and I know there's a Facebook page as well. In fact, if you're on Facebook, just look for Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, and you'll find Jonathan. who's presented it very quickly, and you'll get information there about when the film is the film is likely to be released. It's September. The guys are aiming for hugely important stuff. This, and what Neil was talking about there, Richard, the techniques that he would use and how he described that, he creates the environment for the person to essentially relax and to go deep within themselves. Well, the powers that be, or the people that are hypnotising and seducing us, they're using this technique. They're using it through the media, through music. Music is obviously a big one. When we talked about symbolism in videos, but music, Richard, is huge, isn't it? The music we hear when we're in our cars, on radio stations, no matter what we're listening to, whether it's a rock station or whether it's an R&B station, I understand that it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I think so. I think, Neil, probably correct me if I'm wrong, but was it one of the Rothschilds that changed the hertz of how music's produced?
I don't know about that. One thing that I do know, if I'm honest, I just don't know about that. Like, but one thing I do know is that actually it can matter. For example, a drive-time DJ can speed up or slow down traffic depending on the tempo of the music that he plays.
Yeah.
Sense. I mean, like, you know, we use music for, you know, marching bands and, you know, funeral marches, stuff like that. But essentially, you know, why do Marines sing songs as they jog along? Because essentially, it bypasses a certain part of the brain. It's been shown for some strange reason to actually sort of increase or decrease fatigue.
And that's why
sea shanties and stuff like that. Are very effective. It's bizarre, but music has an incredible effect on people. Again, it's that positive association thing that can also be done. I had a joke in one of my live stage things where I was talking about music just being a positive association, and just for no reason the power of love comes on and it just flashes up book. And that, again, that works. If you know, the it's called a mnemonic jingle. It's an earworm that gets in your head in order to make you remember the product.
Number of listeners have asked me, when I mentioned you were coming on today, I think everybody who gets some information through the independent media, they've watched the John Carpenter film They Live. And that was a very important film for the aforementioned David Icke. He's not got as many mentions now. It's been a long time since he was mentioned as much. He talked about it, and in a very early presentation, he was very fascinated by it. Was John Carpenter onto something? Were the filmmakers onto something? That film, I believe, starred a wrestler called Roddy Piper, and he saw the world differently when wearing glasses and not wearing glasses, and he saw it through the advertising and stuff.
It's certainly true on an analogy level, isn't it? Like, do you know what I mean? This is the point. Like, advertising is there to lie to you, to direct your behaviour in one way or another, some on a sliding scale of nefariousness. But once, I mean, you actually said it earlier, Richie, basically, like, once it is very much like a magic trick. Once somebody's shown you that the coin is hidden behind his finger and he moves his hand around in such a way that he's distracting you with his other hand, then you go, oh, it's in your pocket, mate. You're not so bamboozled.
You don't fall for it.
So yeah, it is. It's working out the method. So once you see it and you go, oh, I've seen this before. Hang on, I see what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and that's what the film's about. The film is about looking at all these different areas of your life: religion, politics, policing. It goes into medicine, it goes into 5G, and looking at these same tricks and sleights of hand that actually are the same tricks across the board. And once you realise that, you can see the trick coming, and it gets in your mind, and you start to see these little signs straight away, and you become less susceptible to being taken advantage of.
I'll give you two examples straight off the top of the bat that are related to music. Church services in evangelical places and shopping centres. And just like, what the hell, Neil? Right, allow me, indulge me. When you watch, say, Benny Hinn or one of these sort of nutters on the telly, and they've basically got huge arenas of people who are sort of readily shelling out money into their gold plates and never once questioning it, there's certain things that they're doing there. You'll notice they're all stood with their arms in the air.
Yeah.
Now, they're praising Jesus, obviously. They're not. They're in a torture position, and they're being fatigued. There's music going on. Now, how music works is that basically it fills up a certain amount of brain matter. You've got to think of your brain as like a sort of bandwidth or whatever. And if you can fill a certain amount of that with music, boom, done. You've only got a finite amount of reasoning capacity left over. And that's exactly why they have people on stage. This is the same reason they have it in supermarkets, essentially, because if you're thinking less, you might be tricked by the other advertising mechanisms that are going on there, like red stars and chocolate by the till and stuff like that. Well, in the sense of the evangelical church, what they're also doing is they're getting you to repeat a mantra. Now, this would be a hymn, or every so often they'll say praise Jesus or amen or something like that. Not suggesting there's anything terrible about those particular words. It's how the words are used. What they're doing is, again, it's that hypnotic, repetitive thing whereby you've got a certain amount of your brain full, you've got a certain amount of your brain thinking, oh, good crikey, I'm tired, and then you've got a certain amount of your brain remembering these mantras and acting it out. Also, you're then part of a larger audience, a large group, so that de-individuation takes place and you become, again, part of a larger audience, essentially.
And this, you don't even realise
it. This thing is going like, wow, I feel so drained, so emotionally drained. Wow, I was really touched by the Spirit. And then you check your wallet.
This will make sense. This will make sense to a lot of people. I've got a question for Richard. Before that, though, friend of the program's Coca Bell, who is a musician and a songwriter, she says, Richie, when you add the three frequencies from a chord and divide them by three, you'll get a harmonic series that'll run in sequence 3, 4, 5 or whatever. This is why we begin at 440 hertz, so that it adds up. No conspiracy to interfere with your pineal gland, says Coca Bell.
That could well be it, yeah. I mean, all I did was I read something. I know Gareth Icke records things in what was the different type of hertz that was recording before. So, yeah, there was a changeover at some point.
Yeah, it's just an opinion, yeah. Thanks for that, Coca Bell. She'll say it's a fact, but it's an opinion. Now, the illusion of choice. Again, folks, Richard Willett and Neil Saunders are our guests. You know Neil from coming on the programme. This is Richard's first visit. We'll have him back again to chat to him about his career and his podcast. Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis will be available in September. The trailer is brilliant. This is really, it is cutting-edge stuff. And I'm not trying to oversell this. It is cutting-edge stuff, this. The illusion of choice. This is scary stuff for people. Even, you know, for a guy like me who's very, it's difficult to shock me. This idea that, I'm a big tough Irish guy. At least I pretend to be anyway. I'm not really in real life. But I think that I'm in total control. I'll decide what to wear. I'll decide what, you know, colour I'm going to paint the walls. I'll decide which film to see. And I'll decide for myself what I think about religion. I'll decide for myself what I think about politics. But I'm getting increasingly more aware of, and it's down to the work of guys like you, and I mean that, I'm not patronising you, that a lot of the choices I think I've made, I didn't make them, Richard.
I think it's because what we're kind of understanding is, yes, we can make choices, but only amongst the choices that we're given.
The narrow
band. So if you give me Boris Johnson and this other Wally, then what choice have I got to choose one of them? I've got to kick up the arse or a slap in the face. It depends on what. Yes, you can choose, but I will give you the things you can choose amongst. And all of these choices really lead back to what's best for the person who's selling them. So, yes, we have choice, but it's a fragmented choice. It's not a choice on understanding. If we don't know who we truly are, who we are as people, if I'm not actually, like David Icke says, he's not David Icke, he's part of a consciousness. If we don't understand who we truly are, then how can we make choices? We're only using the information that we've got.
Yeah.
And for many, many years, it seems like thousands of years, the information has been controlled. So it's coming to a boiling point now, I think, where the information needs to change. So the very, very, very quick example of that is this left-right paradigm. There is no left-right. There hasn't been for years. I mean, how more blatant can it be than a vote that's been overturned? I mean, so there is no left and right. So what do you choose? Where do we go? And I think people hold on to that left or right, Labour or Conservative. Fear. Because what else do you do?
They worry about anarchy. You hit the nail on the head, Richard, because I've had conversations with people and they've said, well, what else is there, Richie? Anarchy? And I had a conversation with a lady recently and she said, I think you might be right in your assertion that we will never change anything through the ballot box. But imagine we got rid of all them. What are we left with then? She said, the fittest, the strongest are knuckle draggers like Tommy Robinson and the morons that follow him around. Are they going to be running things? And that's a real fear that people have. Genuine fear.
Yeah, I agree. But also it comes down to individual understanding. And I think it really does come down to, and it sounds really airy fairy and spiritual, but I suppose you've got to kind of be the change that you want others to be. So just treat people well. And if you want people to treat you well and treat them well, it has to. I actually think that one of the ideas is to bring it back down to small communities. My dad used to be a greengrocer. When I grew up, I'm only 38, but when I grew up, ain't that long time ago, we had a greengrocer's, we had a sweet shop, and we had a newsagent's, and we had a butcher's, all in one row in a small area. And I think it needs to come back down to small communities again, helping each other within that small area. You have to, that's the only idea that I can come up with.
No, it's good. Before Neil comes back in, for anybody who wants to explore that, do check out. I know it's a big production and I know there was money behind it, but the film about Walmart, the high cost of low price and what the massive superstores did to communities, and I saw it in my own community in Ballybeg in Waterford City. It's really important what you're talking about there, Richard. That's, we could do a whole show on that. Before Neil comes back in, loads of tweets. Patricia says, it seems to me the same mind control for the good Christians has been used for the control of the cult followers of Trump. These people need to step out of their control systems and try to think for themselves. That's just my opinion, says Patricia. But Neil, on that, Richard spoke very well there about the illusion of choice in politics. Mm-hmm. But how do I know? When I decide on any given morning, like last Saturday morning, out of the blue, Neil, I'm sitting there, there's a load to do, moved into a new house, it's like a bomb, there's plenty to do, and all of a sudden, I get an inclination to go and buy something. I'm not going to say what it is, it's not dirty or smutty or sexy or anything like that, but I got an inclination, and I did. Now, was that just my imagination, all by myself, or is something else going on? This is what scares me. Is any choice made really my choice, or do we go right down to the bare bones of when I get up and go to the fridge? This is what I'm getting at. I worry about it. How deep does it go, basically?
It can go pretty deep, because essentially, you know, there's advertising is an incredibly huge industry that works on association and mechanisms that you don't fully understand. So what's happened with that is either the slogans appeal to you, the idea of the products appeal to you, or the idea of what the product represents appeals to you. It depends very much on what it was. But I mean, I'm sure I've said this before, but like the best example is that you give people a reason to buy something, then you give them an out for why they bought it, and the reason is to appeal to the reptilian nature. It's something that basically is going to be fun, and so the best example of this is the Hummer car. It was sold as a weapon because it is a weapon. It's a stripped out ex-military vehicle. It's a weapon. You're going to be feared on the road, right? Okay, but how is it sold? Protect your family. That's the justification. That's the out of it. So it depends on what happens. You probably might have gone, looked at everything around you and gone, crikey, look at all this work, and something's popped into your head, an advert that says, you deserve a break. Fancy a Kit Kat.
Yeah.
How did that happen? I mean, it's very nefarious, because it basically, it implants concepts about products in your head without, again.
I worry that we're being listened to. That's the thing.
Yeah, of course you're being listened to. Yeah, your phone listening to you, and your laptop's listening to you, and it's watching you through the webcam and all sorts. Like, in fact, on the dark web, there's a site where basically you can go on and just watch random people's hacked webcams. So if random people...
No way. Are you serious?
Did you not know that?
No, I am. I heard that bit. I'm stunned that there's a site where you can go and you can just watch random people's webcams, and the people are blissfully unaware of it.
Yeah, yeah.
My God.
You know, it's a little bit like a sort of more sinister goggle, or far more sinister goggle, sickening, or whatever. Really. But like, yeah, no, absolutely. Your phone is listening to you. These algorithms in place to basically, you know, focus advertising at you and focus sort of political slogans at you into aligned sock puppet accounts next to you to chat about these products and say, hey, you know that thing that you were looking at? I bought one of those recently. They're brilliant, they are. And I'm sure everyone's getting more and more familiar with bots and stuff like that, coming onto negative reviews of, say, computer games or something like that. And, you know, they've never got a face or whatever. But, yeah, there's huge amounts of manipulation behind the scenes. And that's before you go to the sons of the ones that are even in your face, like things like, oh, what's it called? Spurious Rigor, for example, which is just something as straightforward as kills 97.9% of germs. Right. Now, well, that's a bad example. Reduces wrinkles by 84%. It's like, wow, if they've got such a precise measurement, they've really done their study. This must be a really well-studied product.
It's a lie.
Yeah, of course it's a lie.
Yeah, it's a massive lie.
Who was it? I think it was Vic Reeves said 14% of all statistics are made up on the spot. 87% of all people know that.
Yeah, it works 100% of the time, 10% of the time.
Isn't that incredible?
Well, this is the point. I mean, again, it's not statistics are bad in the same way it's not language is bad. It's basically how that language is used. To sort of tie it back to this concept of sort of hypnosis, right? And this is a very extreme example, but it sort of speaks to this concept of trickery. There is an idea within hypnosis that you cannot be tricked into doing something against your will or to harm yourself, to kill yourself or to kill somebody else or whatever. And that is true in regards to, say, common garden hypnotherapists, stage hypnotists and stuff like that. You're in absolutely no danger there. But there are three mechanisms by which George Estabrooks, the MI5 affiliated hypnotist who was using these techniques during World War II, used. And this is the one, is to change the situation. So you're not shooting a gun, you're shooting a water pistol. Two would be to change the target. So you're not shooting a gun at an innocent person, you're shooting a gun at a person who is going to blow up the world, or they've got a bomb, or they're a child murderer, or whatever, or in a war. So it's a heroic act, you're reframing the action. Or the third thing to do would be to just instill such a level of trust in the subject or the client that they know whatever you do would be beneficial for them. So I know it looks like Neil's telling me to run at this plate glass window, which I will surely go through and fall 17 stories to my death. Yeah. But I know that Neil would never let anything happen to me. He's my friend. So I'm going to do it. And you would assume that you know, something happens at the end. It's a trust exercise. Unfortunately, you end up on the pavement.
This is mind-blowing stuff. Neil Sanders and Richard Willett are our guests. Richard directed this film, which we're all going to watch, aren't we? Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, comes out in September. Richard, I want to talk, because I know you mentioned 5G in the film. Now, there's nothing more topical or more current in terms of producing programmes like this, because my listeners, they're talking about this issue as much as any other issue. And the fact that it's been switched on in several cities around the country, there's been no public health studies done on it. We know it was suspended in Brussels, and there's been concerns expressed in other parts of the world. But what have you come to understand in the research, not just for Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, what have you come to understand about the communication tool 5G that we are told is wonderful and is going to speed up the internet for everybody, no matter where we are, and it's going to be fantastic? What have you come to understand about it, Richard?
Well, the first misconception is that it's an upgrade from 4G, which clearly isn't. It's completely different. It's millimeter waves, not microwaves. We have a guy in the film called Dr. Robin Kelly. He's written a book called Human Antenna and Human Hologram. He's a doctor of 44 years. He runs his own practice. And he gives an incredible insight in the film into what is actually going on here. And he lives in New Zealand, and he's campaigning not to have this. Now, the only testing they've done, and this is testing basically by a board of people that are funded by people who have a financial interest in the rollout, is that it doesn't burn the skin. Now, that's because it's a slightly less powerful version of what they use for crowd dispersing technology, which feels like it's burning the skin. Now, if it did feel like you're burning the skin when you turn your 5G on, you wouldn't fucking have it, would you?
No,
really?
You would not, no.
So basically, it probably would be better if it felt like that way. But the point is that it's the same technology. Now, the skin, people say, well, it doesn't harm the organs. The biggest organ is the skin. If you don't have skin, you don't live. It's ridiculous that people don't actually realize the skin is an organ. So why do you think the rates of cancer are going up? We've had microwaves since the late 80s. I mean, the phones are right near our pockets. Fertility rates are falling. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that you're putting something that's that's frying your brain next to your head. Not that I don't do it. I use phones all the time, technology all the time. We're at a level now that we don't need faster internet. Why do you need to have Lord of the Rings quicker? I mean, Jesus,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, it's quick enough.
Come on. It's setting this up for how quick you want the internet to be to the Internet of Things. And then we could see where this is going with in Sweden, where they're putting implants into young people's arms already so they can get on the bus quicker. I mean, it's or the train quicker, which is ridiculous. So you're going to be connected. You're going to be a thing within the Internet of Things. And what's going to happen is when you step out of line, they're going to turn your thing off so you can't feed yourself. It's quite clearly you're building yourself a gilded cage. Now, this is the technology that's going to allow that to happen. So it isn't a case of just 5G. It's a case of where 5G is leading to. We probably won't be around. We're getting on a bit to see this, but our grandchildren bloody well will be. And it upsets me that people are so ignorant to go, well, Sam from EE, who I did have an argument out, I don't know his name isn't Sam, clearly, about this, says it's fine. They've done testing. They've done no independent
testing.
None. Yeah. Absolutely none. So a big part of the film is the technology that's coming. Not that that's on a cellular level. Why do you think they're called cell phones, for God's sake? And they do like to put a pun in there. But it's kind of like the social media aspect as well, which we cover in Plugged In, it's hitting you from another level. We've been bombarded with this stuff from left, right, and center, but we actually are going to be covered in this millimeter wave technology in the very, very near future. It's so like it can't penetrate houses. So they're going to have to put a receiver. I don't know. I think it's 300,000 in one area just to keep it going. I mean,
cutting down trees and everything, yeah.
Yeah, we're grown-ups. We know this isn't good for us. We're not children. We understand that this clearly is not good for us, and the only benefit you can give me is that VR isn't going to make you sick when you wobble your head and you can download your films quicker. It doesn't make sense. It just makes no sense.
Neil, younger folks are more excited about this stuff and are more, not accepting of it, but more embracing of it. Why? Look, slap me for asking a stupid question if you want. I don't mind. I ask plenty of stupid questions. Why are the young? Is it just because as we get older, we get more suspicious? We get more, narky?
I assume that the young just want to be able to download music quicker and faster and stuff like that. So what I think was very great, so I'm a big fan of Rich's last film, which is why I was so happy to be involved in this film. What I think is really good that he's done is he's deferred on this subject to the opinion of an expert rather than go the hysterical route. Because the problem is with all these new things, you know, it's terribly fun to find the most sensational thing and go with that. And then you risk being ridiculed further down the road. So Richie's gone about this by asking a biochemist who you would assume has the credentials to actually know what he's talking about.
He's entitled to his opinion. This is sound journalism. You ask an expert who is entitled to his or her opinion. Yeah. Absolutely.
Quite. My concern about it is, which Rich touched on, is because I simply don't have the knowledge to know about the other stuff, is the smart aspect of it, in as much as everything's becoming connected, like through your Google and through your phone. We're just talking about they listen to you through your phone, you're tracked through your phone, right? Okay. You've got facial recognition technology on your phone, you're being directed with advertising on your phone. This is also being connected to things like Palantir, i360, which is the Koch brothers data mining firm, Cambridge Analytica, Emma Data, Aggregate IQ. What they're doing is they're collecting huge amounts of data on you and tracking you. And basically, they're doing behavioral analysis on you. And the more data points that they have on you, the easier it is for them to control you, to track you, and to see what you're doing. And we're moving very, very quickly towards... there's technology like Trapwire that already exists, which is basically facial recognition technology that's like ties into these databases. Now, they're using a similar technology in China to pull... to publicly shame people, violations, or to pull people out of crowds. And it's a very, very slippery slope where essentially, as Richard very, very astutely put, you become a thing, a part of this system. And people are willingly giving away their autonomy because they're being tricked into it, because they're being tricked into being glamorous person on Instagram, or being, you know, having the most up-to-date product, or telling everybody that, oh, I was down at the Supreme store today and bought this and this and this. Like, there's huge amounts of people's lives out there that, you know, I could go and find out really personal things about people just by looking through the social media data. If with all of this technology as well, like, we're talking 6,000-7,000 data points per person. And, like, for example, Emma Data and i360 are boasting of having upwards of, like, 200 million people in America. They've got complete data patterns of all of these people. And by that, you know, you're far more easily manipulated. For example, Richie, if I know that you like punk music and I pull up in a car playing punk music, you'll probably go, oh, this guy's pretty sound. I'll listen to what he's going to say. Yeah. Incredibly glib example.
Oh, but, yeah, I get it.
You know, that's how marketing works on a very basic level.
The film, guys, I can't wait to see this. I hope it's going to show in a theatre near me or somewhere I can drive to, because I'm looking forward. I really am. I watched the trailer today. I'm going to tweet it out. It's Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, directed by Richard Willett. Richard is a documentary filmmaker. He's a journalist and he's a podcast host as well. Very respected. Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com. You know all about Neil. He's been on the programme many times talking about these issues and more. The film features Jonathan Ryle as a presenter delving into how we're being mind-controlled and hypnotised on a daily basis, but the world over. The techniques used to control us through the media and beyond. It's absolutely brilliant. We've got about two and a half minutes left on this, so if you guys want to kind of have the final word there between you. But I wish you all the success in the world with the film, because I really think you're doing incredibly valuable work. And the production values, you know, your own credentials, unimpeachable. That's hugely important for me, because I'm not a researcher. I'm just a mouthpiece who interviews people. It's a joy to meet people with proper credentials and who do it properly. And I really mean that. So I'm going to give you the final word, both of you, Richard and Neil. And we'll wrap it up today. Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. Watch for it. Get it on demand when it comes out. Go and see it if it's coming to a theatre near you. Guys, thanks for that. I'll give you the final word.
Okay. There is a website, Extreme Danger, ExtremeHypnosis.com. So you can go there and sign up to find out where it's going to be played. And yeah, we'll probably put some clips on there as well. There's also a web series on there with Jonathan that we've shot 7 episodes of. So that'll give you more insight to what's coming up from the film. Neil.
Also, you know, big shout out to Jonathan, who's incredibly skilled at what he does. I think it's going to be a really great film. I think it's going to be good on a number of levels. I think it's going to be one of those things where, you know, if you know a bit about these things, there'll be some stuff that's new for you. There'll be some familiar stuff as well. But it'll work for sort of all levels. It'll work for sort of entry level people, so you can start to show them things and they can get interested in these topics and go off elsewhere. Or for people who are, you know, immersed in the sort of research communities, as I say, hopefully it'll provide some entertainment and show you some avenues that perhaps you didn't see. And personally, I think it's a harping back to, I remember, for example, when Alex Jones used to do brilliant films like Police State, like really important films.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah.
And there was more time taken and more sort of production values, and it was a more enjoyable experience. Not to say there's anything wrong with YouTube, podcasts, radio shows, anything like that, but it's just, you know, it's a little bit more indulgent, if you will, really. And you know, I think it's a very great subject. I was thrilled to be involved with it, and I say hopefully people will really enjoy it.
Brilliant. Extreme Danger, ExtremeHypnosis.com. Richard, thanks. Come back again.
Thank you.
Great to have you back again. Good luck with the film. I'm sure it'll be a huge success. And Neil, thanks for you contributing to the film and coming on and talking about these subjects with us, as you do so often. Cheers, guys. All the very best, and we'll speak again real soon.
Cheers, buddy. Thank you. Bye for now.
Thanks again. Neil Sanders and Richard Willett on the line to us there, talking about Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, which will be out in September. Go to ExtremeDangerExtremeHypnosis.com. Check it out. Brilliant stuff. Hugely important area of research, this, and one that I'm as fascinated by as anything else. I really love listening to guys like those, and I love contemplating these issues, the hypnosis, the mind control that we're subjected to from the time we leave the house, from the time we get up, maybe before we leave the house, until we go to sleep, and even beyond that. So So great stuff. That's it for the programme. Thanks to the guys again. Brilliant. And a big shout out to Professor Julian Petley from Brunel University, speaking to me earlier on about journalism and freedom of the press in the UK and beyond. I'll be with you again tomorrow morning at 9:30 for the newspaper review. I'm not sure about tomorrow afternoon. I did say this yesterday because there'll be a lot of noise around the mid to late afternoon here tomorrow. And there isn't anything I can do about that. And I can't go somewhere else to broadcast the programme. So I don't know. We'll see how it pans out tomorrow. But I will be with you for the newspaper review tomorrow morning at 9:30. Until then, look after yourselves and one another. Going out with the Kings of Leon. I don't know why I chose this, you see. Some sort of mind control going on there, maybe. All right. This is lovely. See you tomorrow. Have a great rest of your Wednesday, wherever you happen to be in the world. Bye for now. Bye.